want to build our ships. We want to build our planes. We want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country.
That's President Trump speaking on Thursday in a press conference announcing new higher tariffs on steel and aluminum. He says he's fulfilling a campaign promise to protect American jobs, but he could trigger a trade war. Plus, only a few people ever get a building named after them. But what about a new species of butterfly? That's what happened to Emily Grassley from Chicago's Field Museum. She's also the host of Brain Scoop on YouTube. Here she is with Andy Warren from Florida's Natural History Museum last week.
It's Wahidra Grassley Day, in addition to being International Women's Day, which was just a coincidence. So happy International Women's Day.
This is the best International Women's Day I've ever had.
We will hear more about that. And voters will pick Democratic and Republican nominees for governor next Tuesday. We'll get you up to speed on the latest. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. We'll get started just after this news break. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 8 days from now, voters will choose the Democratic and Republican candidates for races all across Illinois. Here on the 21st, we've been focusing mainly on statewide races like the governor and attorney general, as well as the 13th congressional district that covers a big part of our listening area. We'll be airing the last of those conversations later this hour. Stay tuned for that. But by next Tuesday night, we'll likely know whether Governor Rauner can hold off his primary challenger, State Representative Jeannie Ives, and which of the six men running on the Democratic side will come out on top to face the winner on the Republican side. From there, it's another 8 months until Election Day. Maybe you haven't been paying attention at all, and now you're tuning in. We've got all the information for you. Joining me now is Natasha Kurecki. She writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico. Hi, Natasha. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And on the line from Springfield, Mark Maxwell is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA. He's also host of the weekly political talk show Capitol Connection. Mark, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me, too.
Nyla, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Natasha, let's start with the Democratic candidates for governor. The most recent polling is about 2 weeks old, and it came from Southern Illinois University. It has J.B. Pritzker leading State Senator Daniel Biss 31% to 21% and Chris Kennedy at 17%. It has a quarter of Democrats saying they're undecided. What do you think? I just want to throw out a broad question about polling. That's 2 weeks ago. How valid do you think that is right now? And if you think any of the polling will be predictive of what will happen next week?
Well, you know, as we learned in 2016, that's always a question that hangs over us. But I just kind of feel like that poll and some others have had Biss and Kennedy so close. I tend to think that Kennedy will end up being, you know, the more competitive of the two of them. And I say that because Chris Kennedy has deeper ties to the African-American community in Chicago. Daniel Biss's numbers there are not good. He's kind of counting on liberal university areas, the North Shore, the city progresses and that type, but you do need that black vote. And I think that's indicative of why we're seeing J.B. Pritzker making this renewed sort of effort with the black community. It's that he's fighting with Chris Kennedy over that. And so, it feels like, and I know it feels like it's not a poll, but I do think that Kennedy will end up being the more competitive between him and Biss.
Mark, what are you seeing in Springfield? How much of what's sort of the conversation in Springfield? And I wonder also how much you all are being dominated by commercials, radio, television, online, from all of the Democratic candidates.
Well, and mailers, too. That's something that's been popping up recently. I think it's hard for us in the media to believe that in just 8 days from now, it's going to be down to two candidates. There are so many different races and so many different campaigns. But recently, we're seeing more of them downstate. Just last week, there was a protest on the campus of University of Illinois in Champaign and Urbana, the graduate employees organization there on strike for higher wages. And so this was ripe for Democratic candidates to show up and try to get a photo op or show that they were with organized labor in this case. And so all three candidates sort of came down at different stages of the week. And they're trying to press the flesh and make an impression with downstate voters. But frankly, the advertising probably has an outsized influence here, where voters are just scattered. They're distributed across the state in a way where it makes it more difficult for campaigns to make direct contact with them. So advertising down here really does have an impact.
Natasha, when we think about advertising, I'm thinking also about the Chicago Tribune story this morning, looking at how small the voting ratio is in a primary. And Natasha, I wonder how much you think if the vote outside of Chicago will make a difference as well, because the margins can be so small in a primary race.
Right. I mean, the Tribune did do a really good story recently about the importance of the downstate vote and how there's really this battle involving Pritzker is down there hitting it hard. Jeannie Ives on the Republican side, Bruce Rauner. You know, Kennedy said he's been there a lot lately. I'm sure Daniel Biss has been there as well. But I think downstate is it's going to be really key here. And, there's going to be a division in the city of Chicago. You're going to see, a lot of the black vote probably go to Kennedy. But if Kennedy can't penetrate downstate in central Illinois, like Pritzker can, that could be the deciding factor right there. You need, and then that's sort of where, Pritzker says that from the beginning that that's what he was going to do. He wasn't just going to focus on Cook County. It was going to be a statewide effort. And he does have more, boots on the ground. Of course, he has an unlimited amount of money to do so. But I think that is where the turning point can really be in downstate Illinois.
Mark, as Natasha was mentioning, all the major Democratic candidates from governor are from the Chicago area. On the Republican side, Governor Rauner was based in Chicago before he ran. State Representative Jeannie Ives is from the Wheaton and Naperville area. I wonder how much you're seeing on the Republican side, Governor Rauner and Representative Ives making their case to primary voters in central Illinois.
We're seeing a lot of yard sign presence. That's one thing where everybody can look at and see. But also an interesting strategy from Jeannie Ives just recently was sending out this little booklet. And I got to say, it was one of the more creative, unconventional ways to approach campaign advertisement. But it, the front page of it says the governor that you don't know. And it tries to basically say Governor Rauner is not with you, the conservative Republican. And so Jeannie Ives has been trying to make that pitch downstate. But meanwhile, Governor Rauner has the power of the incumbency. He gets to go around in official state business as governor to these different businesses and companies and places scattered across the state. And when they do that, they roll out the red carpet and all the employees come to see the governor. Everybody shows up. So it's not officially campaigning, but it has that campaign feel. So that's a very powerful draw as well. So you're seeing sort of the effort on the Ives campaign to spread a message of their own without the power of the incumbency. And so that's an interesting fight that's emerging there. But again, it all comes back to the advertisements. We're hearing that Governor Rauner's attempts to tie her to Speaker Madigan, which by all accounts is just a ridiculous claim, that's actually catching on. Many Republicans and conservatives are just afraid of that name Madigan so much that when they hear the accusation, it gives them pause before they press their primary ballot.
We're speaking with Natasha Kurecki with Politico. She writes the Illinois Playbook. You can sign up for that. That's a newsletter you get every morning. Mark Maxwell is WCIA3's Capital Bureau Chief in Springfield. Let me ask both of you, early voting has been going on now for, in some cases, as much as a month. And Natasha, certainly, I think when you're driving around Chicago, you can tell where there's a polling place just by the number of signs that are available. Natasha, do we have a sense of what early vote? Do we know what turnout has been like for early voting? And do you know what the trend generally is for primaries?
Yeah, so it is. We have some early numbers from Cook County, and that's a pretty good indicator. A good majority of voters do live there. We have right now, I think it's about 30,000 people who've come out and early voted in 2018. And, the Cook County or the Chicago Election Board says the best comparison is 2010, and that was down about 8,000 people at this same point. Of course, 2016, it was higher, but there was a really, it was a presidential primary, and there was a, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, very you know, that drove a lot of people, big interest. But so we're in 2014 with 10,000 people had come out at this point. So we're at 30,000 now. It is high. It's an indicator that, you know, there's an early interest. You know, sometimes there is too much emphasis put on early voting, and because people say, you know, you're going to get your voters out for the primary, are going to come out one way or another. It'll either be early or it'll be later. So it's not always an indicator that more people will come out. But certainly it does show that the various teams are working to get their people to the polls now. I noticed on Saturday, if you looked on Twitter, you know, this was trending on Twitter, which I thought was interesting for their digital strategy. So they're really working to get people out early.
Right.
But not often.
Right. You can only vote once. It's a good reminder for everyone. Whether you do early voting or you're voting next Tuesday on Election Day. And Mark, just a question in terms of, I don't know if there's any numbers for Sangamon County yet or what you're seeing, if you're hearing anecdotally anything about early voting.
Sangamon County numbers look to be about just under 1,000 people as of Friday. The statewide total, that number available on the Illinois State Board of Elections website. But as Natasha said, really statewide, that trend seems to hold pretty consistent, where you are seeing that we're above average when it comes to early voting totals. And I think some campaigns that try to point to signs that they have energy on their side, this is one of those numbers they look at to say, hey, look, we're outperforming past elections, but we're also outspending by a great amount. So people are tuned in more, I think, than they have been in years past.
Right. There's a huge amount of money that's being spent. This is shaping up to be the most expensive race in history. The folks at ProPublica Illinois have done a great job tracking all of this. And we've got a widget embedded on our website that they created that's basically a chart showing the money coming in and how it's being spent. So if you head to 21stshow.org, you can see that. We actually, by the way, have a whole elections page. So if you go to 21stshow.org/elections, you can see all of that information as well. Natasha, I wanted to ask you about the Attorney General's race. That's something that's not a race people normally pay attention to, but there's so many people running. I wonder how much you think that's not something that would necessarily bring people out to the polls, but certainly there's been a lot more attention paid to this race than in previous years.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And I think that has to do with, you know, the mere fact that Lisa Madigan was there for so long. And so there was finally an opening, an open seat. And just, you know, it's the Trump factor. You know, these almost every single ad for these all the candidates, I think there's 8 candidates on the Democratic side, there's some reference to Trump. And I think that's a testament to the fact that now the Attorney General's are just taking, on the state side, are taking a higher profile approach. And they, you know, they feel like they can be the first line of defense against policies out of the Trump White House. And certainly in a blue state, that's something to try touting. And it can become something that, you know, is a stepping stone. You are much higher profile and so forth. So I think there is a lot of interest because of that. Of course, it's a very crowded field. We have a former governor running, Governor Quinn. We have, you know, Kwame Raoul, state senator, he seems to be the party favorite. But then you have Sharon Fairley, who has done, she's a former federal prosecutor, worked with the city of Chicago, overseeing, you know, the police abuse. She has gotten a clean sweep of endorsements. So it's a really interesting, diverse, and pretty well-qualified field. And but because there's so many of them, it's not going to take that much for one person to get the plurality vote. So it'll be really interesting to watch how this
right with
how this
all
out.
10 candidates, 8 Democrats, 2 Republicans. You know, Mark, as we've been talking about all of these candidates, there's 5 Democrats running in the 13th district. National media has been talking about sort of this so-called blue wave in November. What are you seeing across Illinois? Do you think that would you say that's pretty accurate for our state as well?
Well, certainly, and just in the number of candidates running, there is an energy for Democrats to counter-respond, and that's been a nationwide trend. Usually the party in power sees a big backlash that first midterm, and it's the protest vote, or it's people coming out. They lost that last election, and so they're coming out to make sure their voices are heard. I think in the 13th district, you're seeing 5 candidates down here seeking to try and unseat Congressman Rodney Davis, and that's been a race that a lot of people are watching. You know, and that's a race, that's a district that went nearly 2-1 for President Trump in 2016. But some of the Democrats who are polling a little bit higher, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan among them, she says that she has a good chance. She's a Democrat who can compete in that kind of a district. So we still have yet to see how that general election matchup would take shape. But in this area, I think health care and this recent gun debate are two of the predominant issues that could likely drive the narrative there.
Mm-hmm. We just have about a minute left. Natasha, I just want to ask you one really quick question about Speaker Michael Madigan. We mentioned his daughter, Lisa. Last week, we saw Senators Durbin and Duckworth recording calls for him, even though he's running unopposed. Just wanted to ask you really quickly what's going on there in that race. We've got about a minute, Natasha.
Well, I think he's certainly feeling threatened in a lot of different ways because of all these revelations in the political organization. And he, you know, called out the big dogs to come out and vouch for him. And I think it's a, you know, sort of a testament to the fact that there's more progressive people who are coming at him from one side. And then you have, obviously, the full-on assault from the other side of the spectrum, and the Republicans, Bruce Rauner, chief among them.
Right. So as a lots to we'll see what happens this week. We're 7 days, I guess, away from the primary. Is next Tuesday is election day for the primary. I want to thank Natasha Kerecki. She writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico Illinois. Mark Maxwell is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the candidates' position on taxes. We're going to be parsing out where each of the governor's candidates stands on that. And next Monday, we're going to be doing some fact-checking for you before Election Day. So if you have any questions you want us to answer, you can email us at talk@21stshow.org or leave us a voicemail, 217-300-2121. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, President Trump formally ordered steep tariffs on imported steel and aluminum from every country except Canada and Mexico. Here he is at a press conference on Thursday.
A strong steel and aluminum industry are vital to our national security. Absolutely vital. Steel is steel. You don't have steel, you don't have a country.
That audio is from PBS NewsHour. The president's making good on his campaign promise to protect these industries. The bold move is being met with critics on both sides of the aisle. And of course, there are people who are very happy about this, too. The biggest positive response coming from outside of Washington, especially in places like Granite City, where people depend on jobs from steel. Farmers are also taking note, some fearing a potential retaliation on U.S. exports. We've gathered people from all corners of Illinois now to talk about this issue. From Southern Illinois, we have Dan Simons. He's president of the United Steelworkers Union Local 1899 in Granite City, home to the U.S. steel plant. Dan Simmons, sorry about that. From Western Illinois, we have Wendell Schauman with us. He's a corn and soy farmer from Kirkwood. And on the line from Chicago, Phil Levy is a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's an instructor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
Glad to be here.
Dan, let's start with you. It's been a great, last week was a great week for Granite City. 500 workers being brought back to work at the U.S. steel plant. That was the day before President Trump signed these formal orders. Let's start with those jobs, Dan. How long had those folks been out of work?
They've been out of work since the Christmas week of December of 2015. So a little over 2 years, 26 and a half months.
Wow. So I imagine everyone's really grateful and excited and glad to be back to work.
Ecstatic. It means everything for this community around Granite City, for the not only the employees and their families, but this community itself that it surrounds the steel mill down here, and this touches the lives of not only just the active workers, but the surrounding contractors and vendors and other businesses that support that steel mill.
How many jobs does U.S. Steel provide in Granite City?
Well, when we were idled in 2015, we had 1,800 represented and 200 others, so right at 2,000 of directly that work for U.S. Steel. But I also represent the scrap yards around here and the slag hauling plants and supporting units that also feed off that plant.
And was President Trump's announcement a surprise to you, Dan?
Surprise? No. It had been in the works and in the makings for a very long time, and a lot of lobbying efforts and meeting with the Commerce Department, and was set up initially with some trade cases that we had been taking on with the illegal imports that were coming in. So not a total surprise or shock. As a matter of fact, it was an investigation that was initiated in April of last year with a quick remedy behind that, which, you know, we were supposed to hear something around July, August time frame. Then it got pushed back, and to the whole flown-out investigation and timeline that's per the act on the 232 itself. So it was not a total shock, but at the same time, we didn't know where it was going to end or where it was going to land. But once we did hear the findings from the Commerce Department, and they were similar to some of the numbers that we had been seeing, we felt that it would satisfy what it would take to get the 232 action.
Right. So to get that action, which has led to more jobs for you all, as you're saying, it means so much to the economy in Granite City. Dan, I wanted to ask you about the potential other side of these tariffs.
Sure.
I'm sure you've heard people say this is keeping steel jobs here in the U.S., but it could have some negative effects on the economy if this prompted a trade war for you and your workers. I'm thinking even of MillerCoors, which is another Illinois-based company, saying it's going to cost more for beer.
Sure.
This directly. Do you think this is worth it?
Oh, absolutely. Usually the ones that are on the downstream side that are against this were profiting. Clearly, they were profiting from the cheap imports that were coming in, the illegal imports. And once you cost out and you take, for example, that aluminum tariff that you're referring to, Coors and Miller, that the 10% tax, if it was applied to the fullest extent, it would equate to about a third of a cent per can of beer. So I believe if you and I met after this interview and decided to go have a beer, and they announced when we walked in a bar of a new new increase on all the cans of beer going across the bar, a third of a cent due to the 10% tax, I would have no difficulties paying that third of a cent more for that can of beer, buying your beer, probably a house drink.
And if folks have said, I've heard some beer companies say it could cost as much as a couple dollars more, you think that's not accurate or that wouldn't matter?
Oh, no, I don't. That's not the data I've seen.
Okay.
And that's a small price. There's an equal number that equates out on the price of a car, like a $35,000 car, and the price of steel. And again, it should equate with the fullest extent of the tariff. The tariff would be anywhere from $80 to $100 on a $35,000 car. And I think, again, that's a small price to pay for, one, stops illegal dumping, because it is illegal. And then it also keeps jobs here in the United States, as opposed to, you know, employing labor in another country and their economy.
That's Dan Simmons. He's president of the United Steelworkers Local 1899 in Granite City. 500 workers back on the job. Dan, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Phil Levy's also with us from Chicago. He teaches at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He's a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Hey, Phil, welcome back to the 21st.
Good to be back.
So can you explain a little bit about what Dan was talking about? For people who aren't familiar, he was talking about illegal imports and 232 and the rule. Can you explain a little bit of what the case was that the president made for these tariffs against steel?
Yeah, actually, and I have to start by correcting some stuff which is not accurate. This has nothing to do with illegal sales of steel, although the president himself made the same sort of confusion. It is illegal to dump steel in the United States. We have an entirely separate procedure that blocks dumped steel, which is why, in fact, steel from China is not a prominent source for U.S. producers, that China provides less than 3% of U.S. steel imports, exactly because dumping is illegal, and I think more than 90% of Chinese steel has faced those dumping actions. What this tariff goes after is not dumped steel, but steel that is being sent to us from, predominantly from our allies, but claiming that it's a national security risk.
So to your mind, this doesn't have this. So, and even you're saying legally what the president did doesn't have anything to do with illegal dumping, even though that's what he said it had to do with.
It's what he said, but you can read the documents, and it clearly does not. This is, we have a, an entire procedure set up to go after dumping. This is a different procedure, which is through the Commerce Department exclusively. It's a different law that it goes under, and there's none of the things one normally proves when talking about dumping. In the Commerce Report, there's nothing that says they were selling at less than fair value, which is normally the heart of a dumping case. It just simply says our steel industry would do better if they had tariffs, and they consider that a national security matter.
When was the last time we saw a president make an aggressive trade move like this, Phil?
A president make? I mean, I think the last time we've seen a trade move this aggressive was the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930. President Bush did apply steel tariffs, President George W. Bush, about 16 or 17 years ago. However, he did that with a safeguard action, which was much more of a standard move. Ultimately, the WTO ruled against the U.S. in the way it had applied those, but this is much more breaking new ground, and especially the way the president has then treated this almost like an extortion racket with other countries. This is fairly novel.
So you we're talking about steel jobs in Illinois, but this is obviously a global issue. I wonder how much, as we think about this, you are worried about retaliatory tariffs, as you're saying, especially because this was pointed at our allies in Europe. What could we be expecting here?
Well, I think a lot of the major producers around the world made very clear that if they are hit with these tariffs, places like Canada and Europe are quite ready to retaliate. Agricultural products would be a prime target for that. We're in an uncertain period, though, because of the way the president cast this, where he said, if countries did the right thing to address our national security concerns, then maybe we wouldn't apply the tariffs to them. And he's already suggested that Canada, Mexico, and Australia would be exempt. His U.S. trade rep held talks this weekend with the Europeans. It's not clear what his conditions are, how someone wins an exemption. Whether they do or not has a really big effect on whether prices actually go up for U.S. steel producers, for example, and whether conditions really are different down in Granite City.
We're speaking with Phil Levy on the line from Chicago. He's a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. I want to go to Wendell Schaumann's with us as well. He's a corn and soy farmer in western Illinois, where he farms about 1,100 acres in Kirkwood. That's about 70 miles west of Peoria near the Mississippi River. He's a current member of the Illinois Farm Bureau. He's former chairman of the U.S. Grains Council. Wendell, thanks for being with me as well. Good morning.
Sure. Interesting conversation so far.
Yeah. Wendell, how much do you export your corn and soy to other countries?
I'm close to the river. I do say the Mississippi River is my highway to the world. It's a 20-mile haul. It goes on a barge, and I contract grain that goes to Japan, goes to Korea. So quite a bit. And this, if anybody along the river systems, a lot of their grain is going to go overseas. 60% of the soybeans, total soybeans in the United States are exported. 30% go to China alone. I can tick off some numbers here. 13% of our beef is exported. It amounts to almost $300 a head in value. 27% of our pork is exported. Farmers are really, agriculture in general, are really reliant on free trade, or trade in general, and free trade in particular, and fair trade would be nice, although that's a little harder to obtain sometime. You mentioned, or Dan mentioned, the dumping claim. We're on the reverse side of that with a number of issues with China. They've claimed we're dumping sorghum and pretty much blocked our exports to sorghum when we have a nice market. They filed dumping charges against us on DDGs, a byproduct of the ethanol industry, a few years ago. We eventually went through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, fought that claim, and eventually won. And so a couple years later, they just filed it again, and we're in limbo on that. So this there's lots of things happening in trade around the world.
Yeah, it sounds like there's lots of trade wars that are going on that people who aren't in agriculture or who are exporters may be paying attention to. Wendell, are you worried about how this may affect farmers in Illinois?
Well, agriculture in general is, certainly Midwest agriculture. We're in recession already. Prices are, have been down for 5 years in a row. Our incomes are down. We're really stressed. So I guess thinking about some of the statements before, we hope to not be collateral damage on this, and that's a possibility. As Dan said, it's sort of too early to tell how this is going to play out. It could all sort of blow away in a month or two, or it could be a problem that we fight for years and could really put us in a even more serious situation than we are now. We could go from recession to depression. I hope that's not the case, but that's sort of the range of issues in front of us.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that is a real range, from nothing to, as you're saying, a depression in terms of economic effect. And I imagine, in particularly in regards to commodities prices. Phil, I just wanted to bring you back in here as Wendell sort of presents this range of what effects this may have, particularly not just on agriculture, but on the economy. How are you thinking this is going to play out as someone who's studies international trade?
Yeah, I think he's right. The only thing I would take issue with is that instead of agriculture being collateral damage, I think it's going to be a prime target in a trade war. And I liked his example of how they had at least temporarily managed to put off some unfair practices overseas through the WTO. It's one of the things we have to keep in mind. We've created this global trading system with rules. Sometimes that constrains our actions, but it can constrain other countries' actions as well. Not perfectly, not all the time, but if we destroy that system, where we have had star exporters, and our farmers have been star exporters, they are going to be targets.
And so, Phil, to your mind, President Trump's actions completely circumvents this system then, as the system that Wendell was just sort of explaining, the World Trade Organization, where trade disputes are regulated. What President Trump has did is completely apart from this, right?
Yeah, the problem is the World Trade Organization does say that if a country needs to do something to protect its core national security interests, it may. It's a rarely used clause exactly because it's so elastic. The Trump administration stretches this past the breaking point. Sometimes in his speaking, he forgets to even mention national security and looks like it's just the thinnest excuse for doing protection. If you open the doors for anyone to do whatever they want by simply claiming national security without any tight linkage, we're going to get that. It's an easy argument to say, you know, for national security reasons, we need to feed ourselves, therefore we need to block food imports coming from the United States. We don't want to go down that road.
And you also wrote that the president's unswerving commitment to this, to new tariffs on steel and aluminum, also cost him his top economic advisor. Difficult situations just got more difficult. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there's been an ongoing battle within the White House, from those who have a lot of experience with markets to those who sort of refer to themselves as a more nationalist crowd. So Gary Cohn, who at one point was a top official at Goldman Sachs, intimately familiar with markets, had been pushing very hard against these tariffs. And at a minimum, his job was to ensure that you had a solid process at the White House whereby you'd have open discussion of these issues. This tariff jumped ahead when the president circumvented the process and did it all over his objection. So we can surmise, and there's been a bunch of news reporting, that this played a major role in his decision to depart, which leaves the president short on experienced advisors in this area.
I want to thank Phil Levy. He's a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He also teaches international business strategy at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. I want to thank Wendell Shalman as well. He's a farmer from Kirkwood, Illinois, a member of the Illinois Farm Bureau. He farms corn and soy pretty close to the Mississippi River, former chairman of the U.S. Grains Council. Wendell, Phil, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 5 years ago, Emily Grassley was hired to be the chief curiosity correspondent for Chicago's Field Museum, in part for her popular YouTube channel called The Brain Scoop. If you've ever watched it, you know that Emily's all about science, museums, communicating all that work to the public in an accessible way. And last week, she was recognized for her work in a rather unusual way. Scientists named a new species of butterfly after her. They're calling it Wahadra Grassley. Emily joins me on the line now from Chicago. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to talk about Brain Scoop in a minute for those who don't know about it. But first, I have to ask, where does it, like having a butterfly species named after you, how does that rank in terms of career highlights? I saw your tweets. It seems like you were pretty excited about it.
You know, it's one of those things where a lot of times, you know, we're very fortunate to for our program to be so celebrated in a number of, you know, popular media awards and things like, you know, I was on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. And those things always feel really nice, obviously, but this is like a whole nother level of, like, recognition that, you know, having a species named for you kind of immortalizes your name in the scientific record. And it's a huge honor. I mean, it's probably the greatest accomplishment, like a sense of accomplishment I think I've ever had.
Yeah, no, it's great. So, and I mean, how often is a species named after, like, you know, you were also the first chief curiosity correspondent for the Chicago Field Museum, but I think it's a great recognition of the science that you do. And I would remiss if I didn't ask you just the scientific question just about the species. What can you tell us about it?
Well, the interesting thing about this butterfly in particular is that it's only known from the single specimen. So, you know, there's a lot of considerations that go into naming new species, and this one in particular was found within a museum collection, and this is oftentimes how new species are discovered. I think we have an idea that scientists are going out and they're spotting a new insect and they're having a kind of a eureka moment when it happens, but the reality is that museum collections hold more new species to science. We're just waiting for people to come by and actually take a look at them who have that kind of expertise. And so this was one specimen as part of a larger collection that Andy Warren from the University of Florida and his colleagues were looking through the collection, and they were a little puzzled by it, right? They didn't immediately recognize it, which is, you know, a pretty good indication if you're a taxonomist that you're looking at something new because you're the world expert, right? So if you don't recognize it, then it might very well be new to science. And so, you know, they did the diagnostic research. They dissected the genitalia out of it, which is a very common way of determining one species from another, especially with insects.
I feel like that must be very small also on a butterfly.
Yeah.
Like, that's like microscopic work,
isn't it? Yeah, I mean, they've got to use very specialized tools, and I don't think they drink a lot of coffee that day.
Emily, you mentioned that this was found in a collection. This is probably a good time to remind people, how big is the Field Museum's collection? How much of the Field Museum is actually on display versus archived or stored?
So that's a great question. And in the museum, the Field Museum is a gigantic place. If you've been here, you know, it'll take you hours to try and see everything. I mean, days or weeks. But we have less than 1% of all our collections on display to the public. And so we have 40 million other objects and specimens that are behind the scenes that we have scientists from all over the world come to visit and check out our collections. And we have scientists in-house that are constantly doing new and exciting research with them every day.
So for listeners who might not be familiar with the Brain Scoop, can you tell us about it?
Well, the Brain Scoop is our educational YouTube channel. I started as a volunteer at the University of Montana Zoological Museum back in 2013. And since then, just actually a few months after I started at the Field Museum, offered to bring me on board and bring my channel here to Chicago. And so in the last 5 years or so, we've created almost 200 videos that talk about these collections, right? Like, why do we have so many objects and what are we doing with them? And what's some of the exciting research that's coming out of museum collections? And so, I mean, it's a real joy and privilege to be able to spend my time kind of being a curiosity correspondent.
Well, when I think about that, Emily, a lot of your work gets out there on YouTube and through social media, through sites like Facebook or Twitter, but you've been doing the Brain Scoop since like 2013. And I wonder, mm-hmm. has it gotten, I don't know if it, do you think it's gotten more stressful over the years to do educational work around science because a lot of misinformation or wrong things also get spread very easily on social media?
Well, there's kind of two sides of that. One, educational content, in general, the sort of educational content we're doing isn't always going to resonate with like a viral, you know, public.
The
right?
earth I is mean, flat, new... people.
Well, you know, it's because it's not necessarily sensationalized, but I don't know if that's the word to put it. But, you know, to be honest with you, like, we receive so much positive feedback. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I don't get thanked for the work that I'm doing. And, you know, when I go and give public presentations and engage with the people who watch our show or even people who are just interested in science, I would have to say that the majority of people that I meet and communicate with are just genuinely interested in learning more about the world around them. And if you can kind of go into these educational moments with an open mind and, you know, a genuine curiosity about it, even if it's something that challenges your previously held beliefs or worldview, I think people are just interested in having a thoughtful conversation about it.
And Emily, getting back to the butterfly species, did I pronounce it correctly? Is it Wahydra grassleyi? Is that correct?
It's like grassleyi or grassleyi. You know,
okay,
my Latin's not good.
Right. What do you think it says for? I wonder how much an encouragement you think that is for young people, and I imagine even particularly young women in science, to know that if they do the kind of work you do, maybe they could get a species named after them.
Well, you know, I think it's one of those things where it's just kind of a humbling experience. Like you oftentimes when we're doing this work, we'll have a video that, you know, doesn't have quote as many views because it's about a nuanced area of science or research. But to know that like the people who watch it, right, these are other taxonomists who are grateful for the work that we're helping to do to popularize science. I do hope that sends a positive message that this work is really gratifying, and I hope that more people would be interested in helping to popularize science just because it's a good thing to do.
Well, and it's a great honor for we like to celebrate people in Illinois' accomplishments. So congratulations. That's Emily Grassley. She's the chief curiosity correspondent at the Chicago Field Museum. You can check out the Brain Scoop on YouTube. We'll tweet out all of those links if you haven't seen it, and we'll have it up at 21stshow.org. Emily, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
Illinois' 13th Congressional District is represented right now in Washington by Rodney Davis. He's not facing a primary challenger from his own party, but on the Democratic side, five people are vying to face off against him after the March 20th primary. The district covers all or part of 14 different counties across central and southwestern Illinois, including Bloomington, Urbana, and Springfield. Today, we're speaking with Angel Sides. She's a political and environmental activist who also works as a substitute teacher for Springfield Public Schools. Angel, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
So this is an election year where lots of Democrats are saying they want to run for multiple offices, whether that's governor or attorney general. The last election cycle, there was just one opponent against Rodney Davis. Why are you running against him to represent the 13th district now?
Well, I do a political commentary on free speech television, and I have for the last 10 years. And there's a lot of information that bothers me where this country is headed. We have the opioid crisis. I've always been an environmental activist, and I think as far as the situation with global warming is concerned, that's concerning for me. I think the outlook is pretty dire. We have a lot of stifling of speech. I mean, I would like to see an expansion of Medicare, for one. But yet Rodney Davis doesn't even hold a town hall for people to express, you know, their concerns, even when things are so dire. And really, so many people are dying with the opioid crisis and the lack of health care.
You said your priority would be to address climate change. What would you do to help stop climate change while also growing the economy?
Well, I think we need a federal environmental jobs program, first and foremost, before anything else. Because the first thing you want to do as a public official is ensure that we have a habitable planet, and that is all life. It's plant, animal, and people, now and forever. And so, you know, a federal environmental jobs program really kills two birds with one stone, because you have, you know, jobs for people and you're saving the planet. I think that's what people are so concerned about, are jobs. But a lot of people have a job they don't like to do. They have to tell somebody they're not, their insurance doesn't cover them. I mean, we need a job that people feel good about, not a job that creates oil spills or is a job cleaning up oil spills. So that's the first thing I think we should spend our tax dollars on.
I wonder if we can talk about health care. You mentioned that. What do you think the federal government should do to ensure that people have access to affordable and quality health care?
Well, I think we need to expand Medicare. It covers all people, guaranteed coverage. It will save the average family of four $4,000 a year. It is actually a coverage that covers vision, dental, rehabilitation, and in-home care for the elderly. So it covers a wide variety of things, yet for over 95% of Americans, it saves them money. So why aren't we running to a system like that that covers everyone and it saves people, the families, money? I mean, when you consider the high cost of insurance premiums. So, I mean that's a no-brainer. It supposedly saves this country $17 trillion over a decade. So, you know, that's a lot of money every 10 years that goes by.
We're seeing high school students all over the country and here in Illinois demanding political change when it comes to what they're calling common sense gun control laws. We've seen very little action on the federal level for this for years. What do you think should be done at the federal level to prevent mass shootings?
Well, I've been trying to put out the message out there that Ralph Nader started, that we have a connection between psychotropic drugs and some of these mass shootings. A lot of the perpetrators have been either they've started a psychotropic drug or they've just stop taking one, either that or some kind of painkiller. And I think there's a connection that needs to be brought up when we're talking about the gun issue. But I think we need to end the private sale of guns and insure guns. I think also
the private sale of all guns?
Yes. I think guns should be sold back to a licensed gun dealer, not just sold, because you don't know who someone is selling their gun to. If that gun is licensed.
So you're saying there shouldn't be private sales of guns, not
yes.
That all guns shouldn't be sold.
Right. Just the common citizen shouldn't be able to sell their gun to just anyone and no one knows, you know, that person doesn't do a background check on that person. They're not a licensed gun shop that would normally sell a gun to somebody. So I think, yeah, the private sale of guns, we need to end that.
When you look at the 13th District, it's kind of an interesting shape if you look at it on the map. It goes as far north as Bloomington, as far east as Urbana, far south as Edwardsville, and west to the Missouri border. Do you have a favorite place to visit in that 13th District?
Well, I like the city I'm from, Springfield, because I get to know people that are more local. But I like all the cities. And Champaign's really interesting, you know, with the U of I, and it is a very strangely shaped district. I think it's gerrymandered to go, you know, further than it should each way. But I like all the communities.
Angel Sides is a political and environmental activist who also works as a substitute teacher for Springfield Public Schools. She's one of five Democrats hoping to win the March 20th primary for the 13th Congressional District. That nominee faces Republican Representative incumbent Rodney Davis in November. Angel Sides, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.